Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dispatch Live. My name is Mary Trimble, and I'm the editor of the Morning Dispatch. We have a set of topics tonight that run the gamut. We've got foreign policy, trade policy, domestic policy, and if time allows, Beyonce. So I want to jump right into it. I have Kevin Williamson joining me and Grayson Logue. And right off the top, Grayson, you wrote about Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary's trip to China over the last few days. Why is Janet in China? What's she eating? Because I've heard that's a big deal. Tell us why she's there.
Yeah, I think that's the main reason is she wanted to try some more local cuisine. I haven't seen any reports yet if she's disclosed what her favorite meal is, but she makes a point when traveling internationally and domestically to try and seek out what is the most authentic local cuisine. I think it was might have been a trip in North Carolina where the folks on like the North Carolina end arranged for her to go to a barbecue spot that she deemed not sufficiently authentic and found her own spot that they then went to. But the purpose of this trip was largely bilateral economic discussions with her Chinese counterparts, largely centered around trade issues. Over the last probably, really since like the end of last year, there's been more and more discussion of the potential issues with China's industrial overcapacity, particularly when it comes to green energy technology, like solar panels, EVs, batteries that go in EVs, and other green devices. And the concern from the United States and from a lot of Western economies and the European Union is that China, which is heavily subsidized that sector along with a lot of other sectors that it deems strategic, they've been doing this for decades with solar energy, more than a decade. The concern is that the Chinese government is essentially going to dump a large part of that overcapacity. They basically produce too much for their own domestic consumption, and they're going to dump that on the foreign market, which will harm all of the hard work of the European Union and the Biden administration in trying to build out domestic clean tech energy through laws like the European Green Deal and the Inflation Reduction Act passed here in the United States. So that's kind of the environment.
You're saying they plan to victimize the world with low-priced, abundant goods.
Yes, and that's one of the ironies of this situation. One of my questions that I wrote down here for the night was, why do we care about getting cheaper stuff from China? But that is one of the points that economists make here. But that's kind of how the trip shook out.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of economists, Grayson and I made Scott Linsacome mad. So he's so mad that he wrote an entire newsletter about it that you can read tomorrow, about the insufficient gloss of what is called the China shock. So what is the China shock, Grayson? Why did we get it wrong? Why is Scott Linsacome mad at us?
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to taking our stripes on that. Basically, the China shock is happened, I guess, maybe about 20 years ago now, back when me and you were just getting into reading thoroughly about Chinese economics.
That's right.
When the World Trade Organization accepted China, they acceded to the World Trade Organization, I believe, in 2000 in 2001, and the United States granted permanent normal trade relations to China, which basically made you can trade whatever you want with China, and made that predictable so that investors could make reliable decisions, that it wasn't a year-over-year approval that the United States, that there's maybe a question mark if someone wanted to get tough on China, normalized trade relations with them, and that opened up U.S. markets to a huge amount of Chinese manufacturing that obviously had a lot of displacement for U.S. manufacturing. And particularly in the last probably 8 to 10 years, that has been looked on very negatively from, I would say, probably, I don't know if a majority is the right term, but a large kind of consensus of economists increasingly on the right and the left. I wouldn't say so much free market economists or libertarian economists, but plenty of people in the Biden administration and plenty of people in the populist right look at that as a bad choice, that had harmful effects on American society, the American economy. It had harmful effects on national security, for our ability to produce crucial strategic goods at home, independent of foreign supply chains. So that's been looked upon very negatively retrospectively. And the concern with this new green technology is, will this be a China shock 2.0? To answer that rhetorical question, no, it won't be a China shock 2.0. And Derek Scissors, who is a China expert at the American Enterprise Institute, I spoke with him for the story that I wrote about, and he basically said, we can say with 100% certainty this won't be a China shock 2.0 because the first China shock happened. There's just so much industrial capacity and manufacturing that we've already lost that we can't lose that again in this case. So it's not nearly as significant, even if it's being built that way in some of the coverage.
Yeah. And I just to sort of point out what issue Scott would take with that, I imagine, though he will explain it much better than I literally ever could tomorrow, is that there's sort of this, yes, an influx of cheap Chinese goods that coincides with these two occurrences, the normalizing trade relations, joining the WTO. It's more complicated than a causal relationship there, Scott says. So, Kevin, thoughts on that? And in an effort to avoid drawing Scott's ire.
So you've cheesed off the economist. So let's turn to the theater critic and what he has. We have a weird relationship with China when it comes to this stuff, because we treat China rhetorically as a sort of semi-enemy, adversary, strategic rival, whatever you want to call it. But we have completely normal relations with, and we have normal diplomatic relations, we have normal trade relations, we have normal travel relations, all that stuff. So at some point, we're going to have to decide if we really do think of China as being this enemy, then you can't just maintain, you can't have direct flights from JFK to Beijing. You know, you can't have the sort of trade relationship we have, the sort of cross investment we have, kind of, mutual economic dependency that we have. There are obviously things to be concerned about in our relationship with China. I mean, it's a brutal single party police state that does terrible, terrible things and is not to be trusted. At the same time, we have developed this, in some ways, really pretty productive economic relationship with China, which is often really very misunderstood. You know, if you look at the if you look at things like U.S. manufacturing output from 1950 until now, you don't see some like drop off when we start relations with China under the WTO. It just keeps going up and up and up. You know, our manufacturing output now is I don't remember off the top of my head, but something like twice in dollar value what it was in the 1980s, adjusted for inflation. It employs fewer people, but that doesn't have much to do with trade with China. That has to do with automation and changes in technology and things like that. So we kind of need to figure out what we want out of it. And one of the reasons why we haven't been able to have a kind of China policy that's satisfying to anybody is that I don't think as a country we've really decided what we want out of China. Because we talk about the costs, of course, in terms of competition for, you know, if you were a manufacturer of cheap plastic injected molded toys in 1999, you got hosed. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have any of those in the country, really. So somebody else, you know, took that shot. But we tend to count the costs in terms of the imports and their competition with American firms. But we often overlook the enormous benefits in terms of, especially in terms of China being an enormous market for U.S. agricultural goods, things like soybeans, other sorts of exports. And that's a huge, huge business. And that is a hugely critical business in the Midwestern part of the country. I've observed from time to time that if you really want to know what's going on in China, like, you know, which bureaucrat gets mouthy about his boss after his third martini, don't ask anyone over at the State Department or CIA. Ask the soybean guys. They know. I mean, they've got a whole intelligence operation over there. They've been operating in China since the 1980s, and they're really invested in it. It's interesting that we said on the right and on the left we've got these problems with China, but not so much on the free market side, which is a really interesting way of putting that. The free market side really is a side without a home. But it is interesting to me, and I think a sign of our times, not a very good sign of our times, that when it comes to trade, and particularly the same sort of sense of economic nationalism, it is really hard to tell Trump policies from Biden policies. Biden, of course, is continuing to the trade tariffs and other protective measures. And my own sort of hunch is that anytime you see a consensus that is that energetic and that sure of itself and includes two morons like Donald Trump and Joe Biden, it's got to be wrong. And it's probably a danger to the world.
We have a question from Victor that's a little speculative, but I think it gets to some of why this is happening right now, if Victoria wants to put it up. He asks, how much will the coming Chinese demographic collapse aggravate U.S.-China relations? Their population is expected to be halved. So, you know, I think this gets at the reason why this overproduction is happening in part. I mean, eventually they'll just be consuming less. But their production has not changed. And I would also, you know, just to why is this happening now? Is the question, and what can we look for in the future, Grayson?
For the economic part of this, it's incredibly complicated as to why the Chinese economy performed the way it has over the last 20 years and their experience of double-digit growth. But particularly the crunch in their property sector is an area that's gotten a lot of attention over the last year, and that's basically fallen off a cliff. So the internal thinking, if you're part of the CCP, is here's this ideologically positive, productive capacity of strategic goods. Let's pivot to that. Let's double down on that. But this is the fear from Western observers when they talk about dumping these clean goods on the market. And that has some economic benefits for us. Plenty of economists are skeptical that they can dig themselves out of this hole by just relying on manufacturing alone. I think they're probably right. But there are some reasons why that's a valuable pivot for the CCP in light of their recent economic troubles. And when we talk about deteriorating relations, one of the potential issues here is it can become harder to actually figure out what's going on. They've stopped publishing some of their economic reports as of late when the news started turning sour. I think it was Xi Jinping last year decided not to attend an economic conference, I want to say in Africa, after one of these reports came out, and just had a video message from one of the other Chinese officials because they were somewhat embarrassed at their economic performance, essentially. But that's kind of why we're having these issues coming around at the moment. And I'll throw it to Kevin for the much larger and more complicated demographic question.
You know, think about Xi that people point out that I think is true is that he's a real socialist. He's a true believer in this stuff, and who's been a little bit embarrassed by the growth of a kind of capitalist sensibility in China after Deng Xiaoping and those reforms. So I think that to the extent that Xi continues to run the show, he will experience less internal pressure about things like GDP growth and those sorts of numbers. And, the old kind of neoliberal scoreboard is not going to matter as much to him, I don't think. I kind of suspect that China's demographic decline will have a pacifying effect. Countries that aren't growing aren't as assertive. They aren't as outward focused. It'll have almost certainly an internally destabilizing effect for the same reason that ours will, because it's easier to maintain a welfare state with a growing population than with a shrinking population. China and Japan are not really very similar countries, but if you look at the kind of change in the political and economic culture of Japan that you've seen as that society has aged and grown less youthful and vigorous, I think that you can expect to see some things like that. Well, a lot of Western Europe's gone through the same thing. You know, one thing, Grayson, you said that made me think a little bit was that, of course, the economics of how China had this unusual period of growth and productivity are complicated, but in one sense, they're not complicated. We see this over and over again with totalitarian countries where they've reinvented the wheel, central planning really works, and then you get 30 years into it, and oh, wait, central planning doesn't work. And the sort of one neat trick thing, the one weird trick to change your country is if you have an authoritarian police state and you're very vicious and very ruthless, and you have a largely rural population, you can get your industrial revolution in about 10 years. by sending soldiers out into the villages and chasing people into the factories and conscripting workers. You know, we saw it in the Soviet Union back in the day, and everyone thought they'd discovered this economic miracle. One that really had was forced industrialization. And we saw it in China. And China went through its kind of Soviet miracle at a really interesting time in world history, because it was really probably the time of the lowest barriers to trade and international flow of capital and investment. So China got that same effect that you got from the Soviet experience, but it got it in an environment that gave it a chance to make much, much more out of it than it would have if it had happened in 1930 or 1870 or something like that. So, I mean, I kind of hope it has a destabilizing effect internally on China, because it's a horrible government, and I would like to see the Chinese people live under a better government. I don't think that they are cursed by history to live under tyranny. But that obviously brings some dangers to us and to the rest of the world. You know, regimes like that, when they're in their death throes, can do some unpredictable and dangerous and destructive things.
Yeah.
But they'll have a smaller army to do it with.
That's cold comfort, unfortunately, Kevin. So we have another question that gets at the point you were making earlier, Kevin, about this sort of disconnect between the way we talk about China and the way we interact with China. Raffel points out that with as much industrial cyber espionage and theft of IP that China does regularly and unabashedly, how can the U.S. keep normal relations? And I'd just like to add to this point, there's a lot of not just industrial and corporate espionage, but literal espionage. There have been, of the James Bond sort. There have been, you know, rings busted up by the FBI in New York, where they've been sort of putting pressure on dissidents in New York City, as sort of a police station run by the CCP in New York City. There have also, last summer, there were two separate incidents where the Chinese government had turned sailors in the U.S. Navy, who had then produced plans and various both of ships and like plans for tactical exercises. So there's some actual hostile behavior happening, in addition to, you know, conversations that Janet Yellen are having that are, you really shouldn't dump all this stuff on our economy. But otherwise things are going okay. How, is there a better way to think about this? Is the economic relationship the stabilizing one, and otherwise literally rocky waters that we have in the Pacific? To Grayson or Kevin on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to tackle the more specific question and then zoom out a little bit. This is a real issue that's been an issue for years and years, of China stealing U.S. tech. This is to some extent, and I'm not sure read up on the actual espionage or cyber espionage or corporate espionage here, but Tesla is in some ways experiencing the economic issue here in China right now, where they go up and they set up their factories and their capacity to build EVs, and then you have a ton of Chinese copycats creeping up that basically challenge their market share. And I think that's the latest that's going on with Tesla there. But the broader issue of IP protection and U.S. companies being much more, I think, aware of the danger of that than they were in years past is something we've seen lawmakers being concerned about that. I think there was a bill introduced today by Senator Romney and Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire that wants to basically consolidate how the United States organizes its exports controls around sensitive technologies like semiconductors and different things of that nature, to basically make this more efficient. So that it's less of a reactive whack-a-mole situation when it comes to U.S. policy. But the broader dynamic here is very tricky. Like, going back to Kevin's point, our economies are so intertwined. Like, we have such huge trade with China right now, but at the same time, we have this growing ideological, harder edged ideological confrontation. That's the exact dynamic that the Biden administration is trying to walk the line on, and it leads to some odd, I think, tensions with their other policy goals. So the administration wants to normalize, or I should say they have a risk aversion to all things foreign policy, I would say, generally speaking. They want to turn down the temperature in a lot of United States international ties and discussions. That's kind of what they tried to do since we hit rock bottom, diplomatically speaking, with China a little over a year ago, in the wake of the balloon gate, and a little bit before that with Nancy Pelosi's September visit to Taiwan, where we broke off all diplomatic conversation. And the Biden administration sent a ton of cabinet officials, Yellen and Raimondo and Blinken and others, to try and get that dialogue restarted. But even with something like trade, there's a tension between wanting to protect nascent U.S. industry on green technology and the Biden administration goal of making green technology cheaper and making the green energy transition happen faster. So there's lots of competing interests here that are just kind of like a melting pot when it comes to China. I think it's just a very tricky challenge.
Kevin, last word to you on this.
You know, I'm not an autarky guy. I'm not a economic nationalism guy, but just a quick thought. You know, my first political memory is of gas lines and gasoline rationing in the 1970s, which, you know, crushed the Carter administration, really changed American politics. And in the 70s and in the early 80s, we just thought, you know, you hear this rhetoric that, well, they've just got us over a barrel, as people would say, because, you know, it's a barrel of oil, because we just have to buy their oil because we've got no choice. And of course, we did have a choice. And what we ended up doing was taking the brake off of our domestic energy production and letting that thrive. And what we discovered, you know, after 20 years, 25 years of allowing development to happen, was that these countries needed to sell us their oil a lot more than we needed to buy it from them. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a similar relationship with China, where, you know, you hear people talk about either semiconductors or it's, you know, rare earth minerals, things like that, as though these things only existed in the People's Republic of China and there were no other way to do it. There are lots of other ways to develop these things, and but you have to let it happen and maybe give it a little encouragement too. The Green New Deal stuff, of course, I think is just a misdirection of resources and it's going to cause massive misallocation of capital, and we will all regret it in 20 years.
So, I mean, there's no graceful way to pivot from the Green New Deal to Candace Owens, unfortunately, or at least none that I can come up with on such short notice. But I do want to pivot there because, Kevin, you had a very interesting piece that was sort of about Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro, but also about much more interesting things than the two of them. To the extent that I must, why must I care about Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro, Kevin?
Oh, I don't think you really have to.
Okay, good. That's great news.
I think it's you're allowed not to read that piece or not to remember it if you have read it. It's not going to be in the history books. It'll be on the New York Times news quiz, maybe. You know, how to put it? There was a certain point, maybe in the late 1990s, when being a conservative became a real lucrative career path. And there are certain people who sort of got drawn into conservative media and conservative activism, not because they had any particular attachment to the ideas or because they felt very strongly about communism because they grew up during the Cold War, they felt very strongly about something else, but just because it was a way to have a media career or a kind of pseudo-entertainment career. You're talking about finding a graceful pivot. Candace Owens has actually been pretty good at that, apparently, over time. You know, she started off as this kind of lefty social justice type. She sued her high school for racial discrimination, I want to say, and some things like that. She's pretty obviously a person who could have ended up on either side of the fence or in some entirely different camp if things had gone a different way for her professionally and financially. You know, I don't really know Ben Shapiro very well. I know him a little bit, and we've corresponded some over the years, and I kind of like Ben. So I say this with some affection, but I really, really hope he's the Andy Kaufman of, like, sort of right-wing populism, and that one of these days he's going to pull off the mask and say, it was all a big scam, and I made so much money from you fools, and now I'm getting all my yacht and sailing off from Palm Beach to wherever I'm going to go. And, but even if it's not quite that extreme, you know, the Daily Wire people and Ben's little media empire, well, it's not a little media empire, it's a significant business. They didn't have Candace Owens out there because they thought she was smart and sensitive and she had interesting things to say. It was a money-making proposition. And that's fine. I mean, we're a money-making proposition. There's lots of media companies that are money-making propositions. But there are some questions about what are you willing to do and what are you not willing to do and how much is being trustworthy and decent a part of your business model in the long term. And I think this raises some of those questions.
So what happened before we get into what it can tell us? What's sort of the episode here that we're talking about with between Candace and Ben?
Well, you know, she's always been a little bit of a loose cannon and has a tendency to say and tweet and write irresponsible and what's the word I'm looking for? Repugnant things. And you know, with the recent episode, particularly in what's going on in Israel and the response to that, the you know, some issues of anti-Semitism that came up, and certainly even more came up among the people who were kind of Owens's online partisans. So after she was canned from the Daily Wire, the response had a very sort of, you know, 1930s German flavor to it, or maybe more like 1970s Skokie, Illinois flavor to it. I don't know which or whenever that was. Was that in the 70s, the Nazis in Skokie, or maybe late 60s?
You're not asking Sarah Isger, and so unfortunately you're not going to get an accurate answer on that.
Yeah. Dates.
Maybe Victoria can
sometimes evade me. But anyway, so it's led to some interesting, or from my point of view, interesting discussions about anti-Semitism and how that relates to kind of organized Christian political activity. So there's this essay that was not great. I mean, it was well-intentioned, I think, in Slate about the idea of supersessionism, which is a religious question about the relationship between the Christian covenant and the Jewish covenant, and the idea that this theological belief is inherently anti-Semitic, which isn't really the case, but it certainly has been put to anti-Semitic purposes from time to time over the years. And we have a really hard time. Sometimes we have a hard time letting the episode be the episode. Mm-hmm. So there's a story about Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro and what went on over there and the reaction to it. But then particularly progressives, but not just progressives, have a tendency to want to make a kind of generalized principle out of this that can be applied to other situations that may be really only tenuously connected to that, really for the purpose of smearing people as anti-Semites or bigots or things like that. Well, one of the things I got into was this idea of, you know, great replacement theory, which has become a verboten idea. It was a kind of standard Democratic talking point for about 20 years. But, you know, you point that out and you get treated as though you're some sort of, you know, QAnon person. And so it's an idea that has been put to terrible ends and terrible rhetorical ends and by bad people from time to time. But it's also an idea that has a history of its own and exists in its own right and that we should be able to talk about in a kind of, at least among responsible kind of grown-up people who understand that we have different political preferences, but we want to have a conversation in which we can hopefully fruitfully address these things. And it's just getting more and more difficult to do that, I think. And people like Candace Owens, of course, aren't helping.
Shocker. I'm stunned. Yeah. Grayson, thoughts on all of that?
No, I mean, I haven't followed Candace Owens particularly well, but I feel like I see her and I feel like I see Charlie Kirk just certainly come up in our Slack channel a lot with the latest wild or repugnant thing that they've said. And I guess maybe this is a question for Kevin, who's certainly been in the trenches of conservative politics and been around the movement for certainly longer than we've observed it. Was there ever like a crop of young influencers or young, like, the up-and-coming Bill Buckleys, maybe in like the late 90s or early 2000s, did those folks disappear? Or are we just paying attention to the loudest voices? Because I don't see many figures on the right under the age of 35, 40, who I would say are maybe doing this for the right reasons, is a polite way of putting it, or not acting in good faith when they're trying to popularize a lot of these. Again, setting aside like the real egg-heady academics, but like the popularizers of the conservative thought space. I just don't see, maybe I'm looking in the wrong places, I don't see those those young figures.
Yeah, well, it's probably, and I say this as someone who, you know, really got into both politics and writing in large part because I admired Bill Buckley. But it's probably worth keeping in mind that the up-and-coming Bill Buckley, when it was the up-and-coming Bill Buckley, had some problems too. You know, I wrote an essay a long time ago about Allen Iverson, the basketball player, and his various travails in life, his financial troubles and all that. There's just something about being, you know, kind of under 30 and very famous that is dangerous to people. And I was very helpfully obscure until my 40s, and then I remained obscure for the rest of my life. So I dodged that bullet. But it's a different model of celebrity now, of course, because you don't need even Fox News. You don't need a cable channel or anything. You can just be Charlie Kirk. You can just be some Twitter troll. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she was just some kook on Facebook who wrote about QAnon stuff all day and parlayed it into a seat in Congress. So in the best of times, giving lots and lots and lots of attention and power to someone who's 23 or 24 years old is a bad roll of the dice. In our time, it's probably worse in some ways. So what's happened, though, I think, is that I've got a whole long story about this. Conservative politics and sort of organized conservative politics really radically changed after 9/11 because it brought a whole bunch of different kinds of people into the movement, and the people it brought in were scared and angry. And fear and anger, completely understandable at the time, completely justifiable at the time, never really left, and it kept looking for new homes. Financial crisis made it worse. The Trump movement sort of organized and focused it and mutated it into something worse than what it is. Yeah, Candace Owens really makes me think of, I have for years been failing and trying and failing and failing and trying to write this satirical novel about the conservative movement. And the basic idea of the story is that it's Thackeray's Vanity Fair, but instead of a rich husband, she's like trying to get a Fox News contract. And, it's a good idea, right?
Yeah, that is a great idea.
You can't do it because you cannot satirize contemporary right-wing politics. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have invented Alex Jones.
It beats you to the punch every single time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, probably the best person in modern history doing that kind of writing was Tom Wolfe. Mm-hmm. And Tom Wolfe couldn't do this. And if Tom Wolfe couldn't do it, I don't think I can do it either. So I despair of ever actually finishing this project. Because, yeah, they move the goalpost on you. Like, every time you're like, this is a crazy, outrageous thing. Like, I had this character who was this sort of, sexually predatory cable news executive. And then, like, Roger Ailes, really? He is so much worse than the guy I dreamed up. And so anyway, this has been a very difficult and disappointing project for me. But the kind of character I was talking about is Candace Owens.
Yeah. So we've talked about the sort of right-wing pop culture, but to talk about pop culture more generally, another piece you had on the site this week was about Beyonce. And with the couple of minutes that we have before John jumps on, I'd love to ask you about your review of her latest album, Kevin, Cowboy Carter. Is it a country album? I don't know anything about Beyonce. I know slightly more about country music, but I'm willing to accept whatever you tell me about this album, Kevin.
Well, the problem is that I don't really know Beyonce's music either. I do know something about hats. And so I made the mistake of just mentioning two sentences aside in a newsletter that Beyonce needs to get better cowboy hats. She's been wearing these kind of, you know, really pedestrian, like, you know, $300 Stetsons that you can buy at Boot Barn in any suburb outside of Dallas. And I'm like, come on, you're Beyonce, you know, you need a better hat. And I gave her some suggestions for better hats. And so, as you know, working at the Dispatch, if you mention something related to pop culture in passing, it becomes, hey, we need 3,000 words on this for the weekend, please. And so I was asked to listen to Cowboy Carter and get my thoughts on it. It's not a great album. I mean, even understanding that it's not really my kind of music and I'm not really the target audience for it, I think I know music well enough that I can say it's probably not a great album from that point of view either. Well, it's got a couple of pretty good songs on it. I think there's a song called Daughter, which is the best song on the album, in my view anyway. It's not really a country album. She doesn't really present it as a country album. It's an album about country music, not an album of country music. So it's got some country elements to it, obviously. And the first song, the first kind of single, Texas Hold'em, is a pretty country song, a kind of country dance song. But, you know, Beyonce had this thing where she was invited to perform at the Country Music Awards, I want to say it was in 2016, with the Dixie Chicks, and then we don't call themselves the Dixie Chicks anymore. And this was not well received. And I don't know Beyonce personally. Obviously, that's not my social circle, but she's one of these characters who has a way of making everything about her. And so it became this big thing of, you know, country music rejects Beyonce. And well, yeah, they probably didn't love her that much, but they don't love the Dixie Chicks either. You know, they weren't super happy to see Natalie Maines there, I don't imagine, either. And anyway, so this apparently really stuck in her craw. And she is from Houston, you know, she is from Texas. And so she's at least as much of a Texan as Sarah Isger is. I mean, Houston is kind of, you know, in Louisiana, really, but it's mostly sort of in Texas. Wow.
Bomb throwing, and she's not even here.
Bomb throwing, you know, I just drive-bys on Sarah. That's it's her game. So yeah, I wrote about the album. I wrote about the southernness of it and the southernness of Beyonce's outlook in life. This is kind of a thing of mine. I've written versions of this essay 7 different times, and one day I'll get it exactly right. But there's a real issue about whether Texas is southern or isn't. Like, there are parts of Texas that are really in the south. Like, if you're in Beaumont, you're in the south. Like, you may as well be in Mobile or something. If you're in Amarillo, no, you're in Colorado, whole different place. If you're in El Paso, you're basically in Arizona or California. And so Beyonce, being from Houston, and her parents are from, her mother's from Louisiana, and her father's from Alabama. So they've got, she's got a real southern household coordinate, you know, growing up, and that's her frame of reference. So it's in some ways more of a southern record than it is a record, as we pretend that they're still records, more of a southern album than it is a country one. But it's worth a listen. And I think it's interesting. There's this kind of weird cultural moment we're in where country is really very popular, but this sort of a country affectation. And my guess about this is this really has to do with Old Town Road. And where you get this guy who was like 17, right? Wow. And he's in his bedroom and he buys a track online for $30 and turns it into, boom, private plane money. And that has a way of making things popular. And so yeah. The funny thing about that was, though, you know, Beyonce has this story about how country music won't accept her and, you know, she's not welcome there and all that. Okay, maybe. I'm not sure I really believe that. But like, Lil Nas X has a following. And like, he's a very flamboyant gay guy who sometimes wears cowboy hats and sometimes wears these Vegas showgirl pink feather outfits and stuff. And he's doing songs with Billy Ray Cyrus and they're on the radio. So maybe this is not as, you know, kind of small-minded a country and as parochial a country as people think it is. You know, Cowboy Carter came with this kind of, you know, preemptive cultural strike that, you know, Beyonce is going to make this record and all the wrong people are going to hate it. Well, mostly they didn't have anything to say about it, but some people are probably going to like it. And I bet you it sells. It'll make $100 million. And, you know, I've written things that are unpopular too. And none of them made $100 million.
Well, thank you for that. And you've convinced me to listen to it, which I wasn't going to do otherwise. So for better or worse, I will stream it.
I don't know who all plays on it, but she's got really good musicians.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. I can get behind if there's a good guitar lick somewhere in there, then I can
more guitar than your typical Beyonce track. Yeah.
All right. Well, then maybe this is the Beyonce for me. With that, I want to bring in John for our last segment here about young people. So actually
I'm with it.
Kids. Flowing quite naturally into what John wrote about this week. young people and their voting tendencies and how they may or may not at all vote in 2024. And John, I don't know if I should be like sad that you figured out how to a way to turn a Nats game into work, or impressed that you figured out how to turn a Nats game into something you could claim plausibly as being work.
So standing outside of a Nats game for 2 hours.
Oh, so you didn't actually go into the Nats?
No. I was catching people as they were going from the Metro stop to the game. What's the place called? The bullpen bar, whatever that is.
Yeah.
I tried to go in there and thought, no, it was actually people interacting and having fun. You really want to catch people standing in line or walking and talking. So, you know, it's nice. It's nice to have some like physicality to reporting, actually getting out there, chasing people down the street. Most people saying, don't talk to me, go Phillies, I hate politics, stuff like that. But
I'd like to point out that so far, this is an episode of The Wire. The reporter hanging outside the baseball game, talking to people, powerful quotes.
Yeah, we're going to check those names, make sure those names are real people.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've got the audio. Trust me, I don't any chances.
Yeah. So what did those people standing outside the baseball game tell you, John?
Well, I did. I didn't quite make this clear, but I should have said I was targeting people in Phillies garb because I wanted I didn't exclusively want potential swing state voters, but they obviously, you know, matter more than your typical Virginia or Maryland or DC residents. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't, listen, there's always, I talk to a lot of pollsters as well and polling analysts, try and get a bigger picture, random samples, scientific, methodological, all that stuff. But, you know, the ones that I talked to, there really was a lot of blasé, you know, sentiment towards the election, people saying they're not going to vote. You know, the few people, the people who were willing to say, yeah, I'm for Biden, it was that he's not Trump. You know, lesser of two evils is the phrase, and I think that's what all the people, you know, even people who are actually going out and taking a more scientific approach to this, talking to young people, that's how they feel towards the whole election. Some RFK Jr. curiosity, normal people who said, is it still Trump and Biden? Really? And like, you know, it's just good to meet people who aren't sure who the presidential candidates are, because it reminds you that these people may very well decide the presidential election. It was an interesting couple hours, but I also had a lot of fun. I thought more insightful to actually talk to the the pollsters and the polling analysts, I would say, just to get a better sense of where things may or may not stand. But that is also a very unclear picture as well.
Right. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of hand wringing right now, particularly on the left. Several polls that you cite in your piece showing Biden's support, I mean, maybe softening is the right word among young voters. What does the picture look like? And I mean, can we know it all? Or is there anything sort of, are the red flags and the blinking flashing lights on the dashboard correct, premature, worthwhile?
I think, you know, the smartest people that I spoke to, I think they all think that there will be some erosion, but the question is, you know, it's not going to be, I mean, the polls showing young people with Trump leading Biden seem just impossible to believe, given, you know, the recent history. I mean, it hasn't always been this way. This is something important to remember, something Nate Silver's pointed out, that back in, you know, as recently as the 90s, the early 2000s with Bush, you know, Bush, Kerry, Bush, Gore, you know, these were single digit divides. But since the Obama and Trump era, you know, it's been something like, you know, Democrats by 20, 30 points, somewhere in that range. I think that, you know, what we're seeing in the polls right now, I mean, back in November, it was a little more clear that there was a consistent pattern in all these polls, showing them basically running even. And you get wide swings, to get a little bit into the weeds, a little more than I did in the piece. You know, you can have a valid poll that, you know, gets everybody right by, it has the right number of people who are college educated versus non-college educated, gets the right breakdowns by racial demographics, gets the right breakdowns by age. But within those subsets, it might be off. It all balances out in the end. But so, for example, if your 18 to 29 demographic is, let's say, much more non-college than it actually is, then it's just going to skew Republican, even if you balance everything out overall. So that's just one thing to consider here. But I mean, I think you are seeing some, everybody's basically saying, yes, there is erosion. Does this actually stick? How much does the RFK candidacy fade in the end? Third party voters, you know, they usually don't get what they're getting in the polls. People feel like they're throwing their vote away. Is the stated support for none of the above or RFK, is that just a way of saying, I really don't want these two people to be our nominees? It's a way to register disapproval. And especially when people are saying, you know, in when there's a live conversation going on, as recently as, you know, what, a month ago, right before the State of the Union, you know, major discussions about getting rid of Biden. And if I know the polls have sort of evened up, I guess. But if you have a big, you know, another Biden 3-point deficit, I'm sure we'll get another, you know, can he be dropped at the convention? And so a lot of questions about, you know, is this real? To what extent? And I think the point that I try to drive home is that, listen, it doesn't need to be Trump winning under 30 voters, you know, but if he does, I don't know, 8 points better, 7 points better, 10 points better, you could do some, an outsized gain among them. And the reasons to think that the outsized gain would be real are things, are other phenomena. For example, all the other polls are showing the people with less income are ready to vote much more in favor of Trump by something like 10 points. There's been an improvement. So young people have fewer assets, lower income, inflation's biting them. They're the kind of people who, it's not just housing costs, you know, it's not just the spike in inflation, the rise in interest rates, people not just buying houses, but thinking about buying their first house in the next 5-10 years. These are people who are, you know, they have credit card payments rolling over month to month. I think I just saw tonight the average rate on a new car loan is at 8%. I mean, these things, the cost, Larry Summers had a great paper recently on the cost of money. You need to really factor in interest rates, not just in terms of housing to think about. Anyway, so there's lots of stuff going on here, lots of people. But I mean, we actually have two real young people here with us tonight. So what are you thinking? Why weren't you assigned this story, given that you actually know people who are and don't have to like lurk outside of a stadium like a creep in a trench coat?
John, I think I've already spoken too much. So let these middle-aged people get to it.
No, I really enjoyed reading the story, John, because it is, like you mentioned, a helpful reminder of, I find myself doing this more and more as we get closer to the election, of trying to put myself back in the shoes of like early college or late high school, where I didn't follow, like I was interested in politics, but more so like the philosophy of politics and less the actual day-to-day politics. And trying to remember what it felt like to be a few steps removed from everything that's going on, and what are the assumptions you make about candidates, or it's almost like you have fuzzy opinions because it's through so many filters. You're not listening to CNN or Fox News. You're not even, what are those channels? I mean, honestly, if you're a 19-year-old today, like you don't even know what those are, basically, to the extent that you pay attention to the news. So that's a fun mental exercise, and it was fun to kind of to read the piece with that in mind. Of there's so much context if you've been paying attention closely to the news, particularly since 2020, that you hear someone who has this opinion or that opinion, and you kind of want to go like, ah, like don't you understand? But it's like that's actually the default normal way most Americans, and certainly a large segment of young people's, pay attention, or rather don't pay attention to politics. And that's probably a healthy thing net writ large for the country, I would argue. But it certainly poses a challenge for candidates like Trump and Biden trying to get people to vote for one of these very, very old men.
I was, you know, I went to a very wonderful, but also very liberal college. The thing that's dividing that campus right now is, like so many other campuses, Israel and the war in Gaza. And I think a lot of the, like, if you ask, you know, the Democratic strategist who's wringing their hands about the youth vote, why young people are skeptical of Joe Biden, it seems my gut tells me that they would probably say something about Israel and Gaza. Mm-hmm. Because that's an issue that, I mean, we've talked about it a lot at the Dispatch, the way the TikTok has sort of just created a firestorm over this among young people, because that's mostly how they get their news. And a lot of what is on there is inaccurate or slanted in one way. So John, did you find that Israel and Gaza was playing into this as much as maybe the received wisdom seems to suggest that it is? I mean, we have Drucker in Michigan now sort of feeling some of this out for himself as well. But what was your sense reporting this?
Well, I talked to two very smart political analysts who had differing opinions. Dave Wasserman, who is at the Cook Political Report, he thinks it's huge. He says it's really big. There's been some reporting on that in the New York Times. Some polls show, you know, the kind of people who are very strongly against Israel's war on Hamas are exactly the kind of voters that Biden needs. I talked to another very smart analyst, Patrick Ruffini. He's a pollster at Echelon Insights. He says, listen, this is just overblown. These people are going to show up. Are you going to have some, these people are going to vote. Are you going to have some defection to Jill Stein, Cornel West? Maybe, but it'll be marginal. He says the bigger issue is it's the Latino voter who is 28 and watches Ultimate Fighting and really doesn't have a fixed ideology. Like, that's the person that you've got to be concerned about is, does he show up? And if he shows up, he's probably going to show up for Trump this time. So I met at least a couple people, you know, who cited Gaza. But again, I was going deliberately towards a non-college environment when I wanted my man on the street interviews. I wanted people who like baseball on Saturday afternoon, not watching TikToks about, you know, whatever. So,
yeah. So I want to move to the last topic. If anyone has last words on young people,
I want to congratulate John for in crazy times. You want to find the most psychotic group of people to talk about their politics. Philadelphia sports fans is hard to improve on.
But ones who were allowed by, you know, they didn't have any court orders, you know, keeping them, you know, local. So they were allowed to travel at least. So I felt a little safer. You know, I didn't think there'd be any, no batteries would be thrown at me.
Did you expend your body armor or?
I already had it.
Okay. Important.
Well, I want to talk about one of the other big issues in this election with the last few minutes that we have, and that's abortion. And Trump on Monday finally sort of said where he comes down on, you know, this question of what the appropriate limitations are as far as he's concerned. But he also did seem to sidestep the whole question in a lot of ways. Grayson, you wrote about this for today's Morning Dispatch. So talk us through what that video was, how it was received, and we'll bring John and Kevin into that too at that point.
Yeah. It's funny because this is obviously a very significant part of the 2024 campaign and was big news this week, but it's actually basically what Trump has been saying for a while now. About the issue especially since the 2022 midterms, where a lot of the candidates that he backed underperformed, Republicans underperformed generally, and his argument there, with you can attribute various levels of credence to, is basically this is abortion's fault, and the right has to come up with a better way of dealing with this. This isn't my fault. We need to figure this out. But since last year, he said that, like, he thinks this should be up to these states. He's adopted the one position, one of the traditional positions among conservatives on the pro-life, which was the real issue here predominantly is Roe. Roe was a legal error. Therefore, we need to return this to the states and then it can be battled out of the states. There's obviously other people in the pro-life movement who disagree with that as the strategy or the goal. But Trump has basically tried to paint with a pretty broad brush and saying, like, everybody always agreed that this is what we were supposed to do, and that's what I did, and it was a great victory, and that's where we're going to leave it. After he made this video statement on Monday, he then kind of further said the quiet part out loud on Truth Social, when you had Susan B., the SBA Pro-Life America president, criticizing Trump, but also making clear that they were going to basically support him by saying that we'll work, do all the work we can to defeat Joe Biden in November. And then Senator Lindsey Graham saying he respectfully disagreed with Trump. And in his response to those criticisms, he basically said that the reason why I'm doing this is so that we don't have to talk about this. Like, we need to talk about all these other issues. We need to talk about the failing border and inflation. And now that I've said this, I've fixed it. So be thankful that I fixed it. That was basically the tenor of, like, he doesn't want to talk about this in November. And to a certain extent, there's plenty of Republicans who don't want to talk about this in November. Like, there are a lot of Republican lawmakers who don't like discussing this issue, who the pro-life movement probably thought that they were in greater alignment with than they are in the wake of Dobbs. You have varying different reactions from pro-life organizations. A number of the big ones have said, like, we disagree with this. We still support federal restrictions. But at the end of the day, having Trump in the White House again is certainly a more pro-life environment than having Biden in the White House again. There were some activists who took a different view, saying that, no, like, if you're going to promote a culture of life, if you're going to be a pro-life president, you have to actually, like, state definitively what your position is, not just follow your heart on a state-by-state basis. And that has some more practical implications when we see some of these ballot initiatives, particularly the one in Florida, a constitutional amendment to enshrine abortion protections to the point of viability in the state's constitution. That's an open question. To my knowledge, I don't think Trump has said, as a resident of Florida, what he will do, how he will vote on that ballot initiative. So it's as a matter of strategy for the pro-life movement, this is a real issue, because sure, you can say that we should do it at the state-by-state level, but if the ostensive leader of the Republican Party and a leader of your movement isn't willing to say, yeah, you should do this at the state level, you should actually make these restrictions where you can get them passed, then that's a huge issue and a huge problem for the ostensible standard bearer or one of the standard bearers of the movement. And he obviously had very negative things to say about the six-week ban in Florida when his then primary opponent, Ron DeSantis, signed that. And I'll stop talking because I want to hear John's thoughts on this.
Yeah, John, and if you could just explain, so when we published this morning, there was really only one state that had this, like, really significant ballot initiative ready to go in November. And since we published, there's now another state where abortion will, not just in the form of a pro-life candidate, but, like, quite literally be on the ballot, and that's Arizona. So could you, I mean, unpack sort of what Grayson was saying there and any other reactions you have, but also explain to us what this new ballot initiative is in Arizona too.
Sure. Yeah. So Arizona already had a ballot initiative proposing, it was an expansive right to abortion. It says abortion for any reason until viability, which is defined by the doctor. And then after viability for any reason of health, including mental health explicitly. And then, oh, by the way, they should be liberally construed by the court. So, you know, basically you say mental health, any reason, it's very expansive. In general, when an expansive right to abortion has been, all these referenda have gone in favor of abortion side. Then you had today the state Supreme Court sort of drop a bomb by interpreting the statutes. So there's a pre-Roe law in effect that since 1864 until 1973, it was adopted by the legislature, incorporated into law. It was in effect for over a century. Enjoined by Roe, and that the Supreme Court found that a 15-week ban that Doug Ducey signed did not repeal that law. It did not repeal it by implication. So now there's a question about exactly when this might go into effect. I haven't read the whole opinion yet. I think some people said 2 weeks, other people said it would take 2 months. And the party, I mean, the Republicans in Arizona have really been running just openly, explicitly opposed to this ruling in a way that didn't happen in 2022 in the state like Wisconsin, where a similar dynamic was at play. There was a pre-Roe law. There was no ruling from the state Supreme Court, but it was just essentially, you know, deemed that it could be in effect. The three Planned Parenthoods in Wisconsin shut down. In terms of the political impact, a little bit of a teaser for tomorrow's Dispatch Politics, I would say, you know, the immediate reaction of all the Republicans and everyone in the media was that, you know, this is going to be a huge disaster for Republicans. No way they have any chance. John Podhoretz joked that, you know, the Fox News decision desk has called at the Arizona at 3:22 p.m. on April 9th. And there's a case to be made that that might be true. I think that, you know, the truth is that the way that abortion played out in 2022 is much more complicated and nuanced and mixed than a lot of people want to admit. I mean, the Democrats and the Trump Republicans both want to maximize the you know, how much abortion hurt Republicans. And I think that the truth, it's a little more nuanced. You know, you can point to a place like Michigan where there was a ballot initiative with this looming pre-Roe law, which a court had struck down, but it was kind of, you know, so that did help boost Democratic turnout, it seems, in Michigan. But in Wisconsin, you know, the Republican Senator Ron Johnson won re-election. The pro-life House Republicans all won re-election. The state and the state's Democratic governor won re-election as well. So it was a mixed result. You know, the candidates who embraced the 15-week federal abortion limit, Marco Rubio in Florida and Ted Budd in North Carolina, won by about what you'd expect Republicans win by. Rubio by something like 15 points, 16 points, a few points behind DeSantis. Ted Budd wins by 3 in North Carolina. The Senate candidates who lost were the kooky Trump people. You know, Herschel Walker lost and Brian Kemp won, not because of abortion policy. I mean, it may be because of Herschel Walker's personal abortion policy, but not because of Brian Kemp signed the Heartbeat Act, won by 9 points. Herschel Walker, for various moral and other deficiencies, he lost. And I mean, that happened with Dr. Oz, you know, who is seen as a quack celebrity doctor. You know, you go down and down the list. And so I think it's a much more complicated thing. Obviously, people on net think that it hurt Republicans, you know, and the ballot. But there is a huge distinction between the ballot initiatives and the actual performance. So the last data point before we, I know we got to close out. Kentucky, Rand Paul sponsored, I forget exactly, I think it was one of these life and conception bills. He wins by, you know, your typical 28, 30 points, whatever it was. And the abortion referenda in Kentucky, similar to the one in Kansas, saying there is no right to abortion or taxpayer-funding abortion, that failed by 5 points. So there's a huge swath of people for whom they're happy to check the box for the anti-abortion Republican and then vote in favor of the pro-abortion amendment. So I think it is just much more complicated. I do think on net, does it hurt Republicans? Yeah, in particular districts, particular races. But I do think that it's not clear that this is going to be an absolute slam dunk now for Democrats in terms of winning all the contested elections. I do think that the referenda, just given the history, is very likely to succeed basically in most places, except Florida is more of a question mark because of the 60% threshold. Hard to get there even in a state that's favorable to abortion.
Yeah. Well, we have covered a head-spinning amount of ground tonight. Thank you, Kevin, John, and Grayson, for joining us. Thank you, all of our viewers. Continue telling your friends to subscribe to The Dispatch. We're glad to have you join us tonight. Have a good day.